In this hour, we welcome back to the show Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at University of Illinois. And from time to time, Jim and also one of his colleagues, John Dickel, come by and we talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky various times of year. And we try to do this sort of regularly, maybe about every season, because things do continue to change. And sometimes we also talk a little bit about things that are new and interesting in the field of astronomy. So if you have those sorts of questions, you are welcome to do that. Our guest here, Professor Kaler, his particular research interest is stars. He's written many scientific papers. He's also written for magazines including Astronomy and Sky and Telescope and Scientific American. He's authored a number of books. The most recent, I think, the one that's actually out there in the bookstores, we mentioned when he was here last, which is The Little Book of Stars. And then he has a brand new one that actually exists as a book. I'm holding it here in my hands, but it's not yet in the bookstores. This is titled Extreme Stars at the Edge of Creation, and it's published by Cambridge University Press. So if you're interested in astronomy, you might head to the bookstore or to the library and see if you can find some of his books. He's also written some textbooks, and I think probably you'd look at his books, you'd find that they're, say, for a range of readers, sort of from your more basic to your more advanced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good short answer.
Yeah. All right. Good. Well, questions are welcome here at 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, again, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, always.
Sooner or later, it's going to be spring. I believe that in my heart.
No, okay. No,
well,
I'm convinced.
Maybe I'm just delusional. I don't know. But anyway, we hope that sooner or later it will be spring. So what are some of the things now as we move from the winter sky into the spring sky that people
It looks like it's going to be beautifully clear tonight, and you just got these wonderful planets in the evening sky, and they'll be with us for a little while longer. You can't possibly miss Venus. I'm getting a number of emails around the country. What is that big bright thing over in the west? And it looks like an airplane landing at O'Hare if you're up in Chicago, except that it doesn't move. It just stays there, at least for a fairly long period of time, very slowly setting in the west. You can't possibly miss it. Look in deepening twilight, almost due west in the evening now, and admire this wonderful second planet out from the sun. At least wonderful as long as you're not on it, looking at it. It's beautiful. Being on it is something else again. And then look high in the sky, sort of to the south, a little bit to the west of south, you'll see Jupiter, second brightest thing in the sky, ignoring the moon, of course. And down to the west of it, Saturn. So you've got three beautiful, bright planets up there. You connect the dots, and you can more or less trace out the ecliptic path, the path of the sun. Connect the moon with it, and you've sort of got the string of the constellations of the zodiac up there for you. And around 1 o'clock, Mars is rising over in the southwest. It's getting brighter. It'll dominate that part of the sky right near its namesake, Antares. It's very close to it right now. That's a big, bright, supergiant star in the constellation of Scorpius. Antares means like or akin to Mars, and the two are very similar to each other. It's a rather attractive sight over there if you want to stay up or get up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, which astronomers do sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're guys who like to be out at night.
That's right.
Well, we're getting to the point where maybe it will be. The problem with stargazing is in the summer when it's warm, the air is not as clear.
And there's also a lot of mosquitoes out there.
Yes, indeed. And in the winter, when the sky is really, there's no mosquitoes and things are clear because the air is more dry, it's really cold and maybe you don't want to be out there.
Yeah, there's a beautiful meteor shower, for example, in January that's easily the rival of the famous Perseids in August, but nobody likes to lie on their back on the snow in the middle of January to look at them, so they're not, they're pretty well ignored. But it is a beautiful time of the year right now. The winter constellations are escaping to the west, and Orion is pretty much still to the south or southwest in the early evening, and it's just a beautiful part of the sky. The spring stars tend to be relatively drab because that's a bad word, I suppose. You're looking perpendicular to the disk of the galaxy, and there just aren't that many stars to look at, but there's some beautiful constellations rising up, Leo, for example, which really does look like a big animal stalking across the sky, and the Big Dipper's climbing up in the northwest, part of Ursa Major, the Great Bear. That's always an attractive sight, and by early morning as the sun rises, you can see the Dipper over, swinging past the overhead point over toward the west right now. It's just a classic sight. So, hey, keep your eyes on the skies. And Venus is going to disappear pretty soon. By the end of the month, it will be gone. It's going to pass in between us and the sun, and it'll be sort of out of sight for a few weeks, and it'll, in April, mid-April, it pops up in the morning sky, and it'll be with us for pretty much the rest of the year in the early morning, even through next fall. That'll be that's always a pretty sight, too, as it gets closer and closer to the sun in the morning. So it's hard to get rid of Venus for any long period of time. Mercury's up there, too, right now. It's hard to see, but it's in the early morning sky.
You know, from time to time, I see devices that are intended to help you recognize constellations and stars, and the kind of things that, that you can take outside at night, and maybe they have a little lighted deal so that it will show you, it'll tell you where to stand, which way to face, and it will show you so that then you can look up in the sky and you can say, oh, okay, I see those. Are there anything like that you think is particularly good?
Yeah, any aid like that can help. Astronomy and Sky and Tell magazines have monthly star charts that are probably as good as anything that you're going to use. The way of learning the constellations is really to find one. And from once you got one in a star map, you just bounce from one to the next, and pretty soon you're all over the whole sky. It just takes some patience and practice and a little bit of work, and it's like any other skill. You learn your way around. Right now, the easiest thing to nail is Orion. I mean, it's just absolutely impossible to miss the darn thing. It really does look like a human being sort of looking back at you. Those three stars in a row right on the celestial equator are a complete giveaway, and then up and to the left, you see the bright red star Betelgeuse, down to the right, blue-white star Rigel, and pretty soon, there's a whole pattern. Look down to the left, there's Sirius, and it's really hard to miss the brightest star in the sky. And if you want to find Sirius, I mean, you got to ignore the planets that are kind of overhead and to the west, but look down, look to the south, and you see Sirius, and look up from that, and there's Orion again. So once you found that and you got a star map, it's pretty easy to start working your way around through the sky.
Okay.
Before you know it, you're even looking for Monoceros and Camilla Pardalis and things like that.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
We have a caller here, somebody on a car phone, so we'll get right to them on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I certainly appreciate your quick response to my call. I'm interested in the pattern of solar energy as when Venus or Mercury are between us and the sun. Does that change the kind of radiation pattern that extends to Earth?
No, not at all. Venus rarely passes actually in front of the sun when it's in conjunction with the sun between us. And as we say between us, but it's usually well above the sun or well below the sun. Only once every couple hundred years will it actually pass right in front of the sun, and then you can see it backlit against the disk of the sun, but it's such a tiny dot, it has no effect at all. Mercury does that rather regularly with periods of 7 and 14 years in May and November, called a transit event, and we just had one last year, and it's just this little dinky dot. It's smaller than the sunspot. It has no effect on insulation or on the heating of the Earth at all, and it only lasts, in the case of Mercury, for a few hours anyway. So there's no effect, no magnet, no, not at all.
Okay. That's all I needed.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
very
you.
Good. And bye. Let's go to Bloomington, our next caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just wonder how many persons saw that spectacular display on the night of Monday, the 26th, when Jupiter and Venus and the crescent moon were almost in line.
That's in January.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
No, did I say January?
Oh no, February 26th.
February 26th.
Okay. Oh, it's beautiful when you see these planets gather with the moon like that. I missed that. I probably cloudy.
Did you see it that evening?
No, I didn't. But I've seen what you.
It was spectacular.
Oh, it's beautiful. I've seen what you're talking about many times over my lifetime, and I still thrill at going out and looking at the moon and Venus or all these conjunctions. They're just aesthetically a wonderfully pleasing sight up, and especially if the sky is still a little bit twilight and so on, and you're looking at them against a deepening blue sky. It's just beautiful.
Yes, well, this is when I first noticed it. It was just after dark. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. That's the sort of thing that I think brings people out to look in the first place, and they can get enthralled with the rest of the sky, and pretty soon they're astronomers.
Well, other questions are welcome. Our guest here is astronomer Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at the University of Illinois, and every once in a while he stops by here, and we talk about what's in the sky, and if you have questions about that, or you have other questions about astronomy, you can call us, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
Sounds like I just wander in and see if the studio's empty, and I sit down and say, "Hi, David, let's go."
And no? You see, no, and I really should say just how nice Jim has been to us over the years, because he's often the guy that when something goes wrong, somebody falls out, we have some
There's
show
always
we can't fill. Poor Jim is the guy
Jim
we call.
Cameron.
Hey, Jim, you doing anything next week at let's say Tuesday at 11 o'clock? And he pretty much always says, yeah, that he will, you know, unless he absolutely can't, he's always said, yeah, sure, I'll come over. So it's not, and we like to see you, and people like to call in and talk with you. It's not a desperation ploy at all. Oh, boy. Let's talk with a caller in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Am I missing the northern light displays that usually accompany the time of solar maximum, or are there just fewer this maximum time around?
I don't know what the frequency would be down here. The your latitude's getting a little bit low. We usually have a couple. I think we had one last year. They come and go. They're chaotic. They're irregular. You can't predict them. And an average number per season, I don't think, means terribly much. As I recall, maybe during a solar maximum, we'll get one or two displays. It'll reach down this far. And the trouble is that it's cloudy a good part of the time. And with the city lights, even if you do get a small display, you'll probably miss. So I really can't answer that. I haven't kept track of the number that we've had. It seemed more or less normal to me, but they're going to be dying out, and the solar maximum's going down. We had the telescope for the students on the sun the other day, and not a lot of activity. It's dying off now, and the new maximum will be beginning very shortly, and we'll slowly build back up again.
In terms of past maxima, has this been an exceptionally a quiescent one, or is this typical? Or
I think it's pretty typical for an active maximum. It was pretty good during the peak. The sun was enormously active. One of the things that we have now, of course, that we didn't used to have, are dedicated satellites that have 24-hour views of the sun, and they are looking at X-rays and looking at ultraviolet and looking at you can see the magnetic looping patterns and above the sunspots, and they're absolutely spectacular. There are a number of good websites where anybody can just wander in and sort of like we have wander in here and wander in and take a look at what's going on in the sun. And I'd certainly recommend doing that on occasion. But I can't recall what the sunspot numbers are, but I think it was roughly equal to what it was the last time. It seemed to be in a series of fairly high maxima over the last few years, last couple of cycles.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. I know that many times on the program we've had people ask about the northern lights, and I think sort of the standard answer you've had to give is, well, this is kind of far south to be seeing them.
Yeah, but you do see them, and you can get pretty good displays. But even a few degrees of latitude can make a big difference. You get up into Minnesota and Wisconsin, and you'll get more, and you get up into Alaska, of course, when the sun's not up all the time. Then it becomes a pretty regular thing, and people tend to almost ignore them up there, so many. But they're unpredictable in the sense that, you know, you can't tell next week what's going to happen. If you get a major blast from the sun, then you can say there's a good odd, what's called a coronal mass ejection, and then you can predict that there's good odds that you're going to get one a couple of days later. And you can see with the satellites, you can see the coronal gases coming off the sun, the things that actually produce the northern lights displays, which we didn't have, 10 years ago.
Is we the kind of problem that we would have even in cities the size of Champaign-Urbana with ambient light, would that be enough to really blot
the
out
lighting
the
is
so you got to get out in
the lighting is sloppy country. In Champaign-Urbana. Yeah. There's no lighting ordinances in town. A lot of the lights just go shooting right up into the sky where they don't do anybody any good. Wasting huge amounts of money, by the way, taxpayers' money, because they're not doing anything. The lights just destroy the sky. I'd say probably, I don't know, a good fraction of it just disappears, and it means you can't see the sky anymore, which is a shame for young kids especially. It's hard to get a dark sight. Once you get a little bit out of town, you recover the dark sky again. Even a couple of miles makes a big difference.
The number here, if you want to call us, talk with our guest, Jim Kaler, professor of astronomy, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I wanted to ask you about what seems to be a controversy raging in astronomy.
Raging.
At least I seem to have been reading a lot about it lately. And that is the status of Pluto.
Aha!
In New York City.
I'm familiar. Yes. Go ahead.
In New York City. The Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum of Natural History apparently booted Pluto out of the solar system. And I've read now a number of stories about this. Maybe it's just because I read the New York Times and it's in New York. I don't know if this has become a national issue.
Kinda.
But, okay, so what's the deal? Is Pluto a planet or is it not?
According to the International Astronomical Union, the Organization of Professional Research Astronomers, they have declared Pluto a planet. Now, it seems to me that the planetariums, which are supposed to be doing the public education from the research people, ought to be at least going along with that. So I'm finding this pretty annoying, quite frankly. I've gone through my own waffling on the planet. There was a time when I was calling it not a planet either, but I'm back to calling it. Man, you can do what you want, but I think you sort of have to go along at least with the official line, and I think they made a big mistake, and it was certainly a big public relations mistake to pull Pluto out of the planets, because little kids love Pluto for some, I guess it's the dog's name, I don't know, but they seem to really be fascinated by the little guy, and when it's gone, it gets very confusing to people. They grew up learning that Pluto's a planet, and suddenly the American Museum of Natural History declared unilaterally that it wasn't, and it is and it isn't. It's a funny body. It's a very important body, and there's no dismissing it in terms of its importance. It is, I guess you could say, it's both a planet and a, if you'll excuse the term, a Kuiper belt object, which it sounds pretty boring. But out beyond Neptune, there is a set of small bodies, which are mostly comets, really, that extend quite a ways away from the sun. I think there are about 300 or 400 of them that have been found at this point. And Pluto seems to be the biggest of them by far. And it's kind of when I teach this stuff, I call it a transition object between the comets, which originally built up to be planets, and the planets. There apparently just wasn't enough raw material out there to make a real planet. But Pluto is in sort of a state of transition, and it got caught in the middle, and therefore is a wonderful object with which to study the growth of planets and how planets actually developed. So it's a truly important object. But yeah, I think it's fair to call it a planet, sort of. It can be both. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It's in a weird orbit. It's trapped by Neptune. It goes around the sun twice for every time Neptune goes around the sun thrice. A word you don't get to say very often. So I use it when I can. It's in what's called a resonant locking orbit, and Neptune's actually got it trapped, and no other planet is caught another planet like that. So I guess this is another reason why it tends to be downgraded from true planethood, so to speak. But when the astronomical community tried to downgrade it to an ordinary KBO object, people got really upset about it, and there were so many letters, as I understand it, the IAU and the various organizations that they sort of retread it and say, okay, it's a planet after all. We'll leave it at that. It can be both.
Well, I'm beginning to wonder now if the folks there at the planetarium Dr. DeGrasse Tyson, who runs the place, might be thinking, you know, I wonder if
they made kind of a mistake in doing it. Now they've rectified it. They've put it back. They're calling it, well, here it is, but it isn't a planet, but here it is anyway. So at least it there's some educational value, certainly, what they were doing. And even pulling it off and the ruckus it caused in New York had a lot of educational value. It brought attention to Pluto and the planetary system.
And Pluto is part of the confusion or the controversy is that is Pluto like a comet in its
structure? I don't think you can't
structure?
Call it a comet. It's too big. Nobody really knows. It's a relatively low-density object, but it's not. It's certainly an evolved body. A lot of the outer bodies of the solar system are very icy. The satellites of Saturn, for example, satellites of Jupiter, outer moons of Jupiter, are mostly ice. And Pluto is probably a good fraction ice as well. You brought it in close to the sun, it'd heat up and it'd do funny things. But it's certainly unfair to call it a comet. It's more compacted. Comets are very fragile, very fluffy things, so far as we know. And Pluto is a fairly large body. It's compacted. It's denser, and it's certainly much denser than any comet. Mm-hmm. And we can't call it that. You can call it a Kuiper Belt object, I suppose, because there's got to be a whole range of things out there beyond Neptune, from real, true cometary bodies to some things that are relatively evolved and have moved away from cometary status.
Yeah, and I guess that's why it is periodically, and we've talked about this too, that someone comes along and proposes adding another planet, saying, well, we've got a planet in our solar system that's beyond
Well, so
Pluto.
Far nobody's found anything like that. They found much smaller bodies. Pluto far exceeds in size all the other little things that are found out there. So it really is different. It's similar to Neptune's big satellite Triton, which was probably seems to be almost a twin of Pluto and was probably captured by Neptune as well. So there may be other bodies out there, but nobody's seen them. And I would expect at this point, if there were any really big ones like Pluto, they probably would have been picked up by now.
Because Pluto was discovered in 1930.
Right.
So it's been a while. You'd think we'd know about it.
It was an accidental discovery in a sense. The planet Uranus wasn't moving quite according to predictions, and they predicted that they found Neptune that way in 1846, I think, and then predicted yet another one, and Clyde Tombaugh set to look for it, and it turned out that Pluto didn't have enough mass to do much of anything anyway, and it turned out to be an accidental discovery. Except I'm not sure accidental's fair. Tombaugh worked for diligently searching the zodiac for bodies like this, and it was a result of a deliberate search. And it's intrigued people ever since. It's the only planet we haven't yet visited in the solar system directly. The last I heard, the Pluto Express, which is supposed to get there sometime in the next, I've forgotten, 10 years or so, has been axed by NASA. And now there's a lot of protest to this. It's one of the smaller probes. And it would be fascinating to get a good look at the thing close up. So small, it's very difficult to see anything from here.
How big is it relative to...
It's about the size of the western continental United States.
Is it smaller than the moon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's smaller than the moon. I'm trying to remember the diameter of the thing. It's hard to remember all the numbers, but yeah, it's smaller than the moon. By far the smallest planet in the solar system. And sometimes it's fair to call it. These terms are flexible. I mean, when I teach planetary science in Astronomy 100, I'm willing to call the moon a planet too. Why not? It looks like a planet. It acts like a planet. It's like the duck quacking if it quacks like a duck, et cetera. And the moon, of course, it orbits the Earth more. Earth is more influential on it than the sun, so I guess it's fair to call it a satellite too. But it behaves like another terrestrial planet.
Mm. Okay. Our guest here, we're at the midpoint. Our guest is U of I astronomer Jim Kaler. He's here occasionally. We talk about astronomy, which you can see in the sky various times of the year. If you're interested, in reading some on astronomy, you can look for his books at the bookstore, at the library. You can, of course, get more information about astronomy by going to the web page of the University of Illinois Astronomy Department, which is?
www.astro.uiuc.edu.
And there are links to various astronomy sites, and there's periodic articles about what you can see at various times.
Well, you get on the main page. I've got a weekly column, so to speak, called Skylights. You can click on it directly from there, and you can get on my star site from there, which we do the star of the week, and describe a different star each week, and which was pretty obvious.
You got your Julia Roberts, you got your Mel Gibson,
the funny thing is I've got an outside page on there which just presents an observatory, and then you get into the inside page. The outside page gets about 30% more hits than the true inside page, probably because people are putting the word stars into the search engine. They come across the observatory. What's this stuff? Where's Mel Gibson? Right.
Brad
we'll get
Pitt.
Off and see something else.
Well, if you have questions about astronomy, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask this question or not, but recently, about 2 weeks ago, I saw a program on TV that claimed that the astronauts' first trip to the moon was a fake. that they only circled the Earth for 8 days and then came back down again, but they did everything to make it look like they did go to the moon. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's nonsense.
Well,
it's abject nonsense. There are people who just won't believe things. I don't know why. Where do they think the moon rocks came from? I mean, there's hundreds of pounds of moon rocks on the Earth.
Well, got them out of the desert.
No, moon rocks are totally different geologically than Earth rocks. You can't fake it. You can't get moon rocks from the Earth. They've got continuous coverage in the astronauts going from here to the moon and back again. Detailed photographs of the backside of the moon from the Apollo craft. It's the only conceivable way that you can get photographs like that.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, thousands of photographs. Pictures of the astronauts walking on the moon, kicking up dust. Now, I know you can fake photographs, but you're not going to fake this sort of thing. Certainly not from the far side of the moon. The far side of the moon has been completely mapped. It was completely mapped by the Apollo astronauts in orbit around the moon. And there's no reason at all to believe why this should be faked. And I don't really understand why people want to believe that this is sort of some sort of immense conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how you take a look at the astronauts walking on the moon. How do you replicate anything like that in low gravity, 1/6 Earth gravity, mm-hmm. kicking up dust as they go? I mean, the list of evidence that the astronauts were actually there is huge. And compared with what, a conspiracy that they got thousands of NASA engineers together and they're all keeping a secret?
Yeah.
The government keeping a secret? How long did it take the Russians to get the atom bomb?
Uh-huh.
The idea of a conspiracy like that is ludicrous. And there are television stations and networks who will do anything for a buck, and I think this is a good case of it.
Okay. Well,
you hit the right button there, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, you really exploded there.
Well, it's too bad because the astronauts that went to the moon risked their lives. It was a terribly dangerous thing to do, and I think it's degrading to them and to the wonderful NASA engineers who made this all work. I think it's degrading to say that it's all a fake.
Well, one of the things they tried to prove this by was the fact that they had a picture of a flag waving and there was no wind on the moon.
No, and the flag is being held up by a wire.
Uh-huh.
And the flag isn't waving. It's just sitting there.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably still sitting there.
Uh-huh.
Now, the astronauts left mirrors on the moon. The purpose is to hit the moon with a laser beam from the Earth. This is done out of McDonald Observatory. It was in Texas and from a variety of other observatories. And you bounce the light beam off the moon and it comes back and you can measure the distance of the moon to within a couple of inches. Now, you can't do that unless there's mirrors on the moon. It's not possible. They put retro reflectors up there.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute proof that people were there. Otherwise, you couldn't do this unless you want to extend your conspiracy to the astronomical community and the geological community as well.
Uh-huh.
They don't tell you this in the television program.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's all skewed to make—I didn't see the program, but I've seen enough of the concept that this was a hoax to understand what the program was about.
Uh-huh.
And it's just sad that I think people have to do this.
Well, I'm glad you...
I hope I made my point clear.
Yeah, well, you did, and I feel very relieved.
Thank you.
Somebody say that.
I'm really glad you brought it up. I really am. I think it's a good opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. So, well, thank you.
All right. Well,
you're welcome.
Call. This is something that seems to from time to time pop up. I don't know when the very first time someone
quick. Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever seen pictures of the Apollo rocket craft? Why would they do that? I mean, anyway, I made my point, I think.
Well, see, you're being logical there.
Well,
that's your problem.
That. Yeah.
We have other callers. Let's go on to, let me see, I guess next would be caller in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Fascinating program. I was wondering from what I've heard, does the moon being there keep a lot of outer space objects from hitting our Earth?
That's a good question. I don't think so. The Earth has a dominant gravitational influence on anything around it. And clearly some things are going to hit the moon first, but I doubt that it would sweep up very much. An awful lot hits the Earth, too. The Earth gets hit, believe it or not, about 1,000 times a day by small meteorites and things from outer space. It's almost a constant rain down on us. They're little bitty things. They don't do any harm or anything. There's not enough of them to do any damage. Once in a while, we get hit by something big every few tens of thousands of years or so. But the moon shouldn't have any real significant influence. It's just not that big a body.
All right. I hope that, that answers the question. Let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
A couple of questions your topics have brought up. First off, why couldn't you just take a telescope and look at the junk they left behind on the moon for that lady's concept?
It's too small.
Well, even the Hubble wouldn't be able
to
see it?
No, you can't see it. And the
Hubble can see all the way across the universe? And
well, it's a matter of size and resolution. The things that were left on the moon are just really pretty tiny, I don't think the Hubble could conceivably resolve them. I'd have to sit down, it's just like seeing, the bacteria crawling on your skin or something like that. You know, you can see the moon, but you can't see what's on the back of your hand. It's kind of the same concept.
Second question, in the situation you're talking about Pluto, what's to keep the outer planets from catching and making it a moon also, since you say it's smaller than the moon?
Well, Pluto's is sort of trapped, as I said, sort of trapped by Neptune. It's in a locking orbit, and they can't actually approach each other.
Well, they never get close enough to trap
No. And Pluto is also in a very eccentric orbit. It's highly tilted orbit, and even though it comes inside the orbit of Pluto, comes closer to us than Pluto, the orbits don't really cross each other. And Pluto's always someplace else when Pluto comes closer to us. So Neptune sort of protected itself against Pluto in a way.
Over millions and millions of years, it never will.
Yeah, that's right. There are a lot of these objects out there, turns out, are in locking orbits with Neptune. They go around twice every time Neptune goes around three times. It's sort of a semi-standard celestial mechanics thing where one planet can sort of trap another one into a particular kind of orbit.
And the last question I have, to go a little slightly different topic, I've been hearing discussions about all the material that's floating around us in space are in orbit of the Earth from things that have been tossed off the space lab or whatever it might be, satellites, all kinds of things have been thrown up there. What's to keep that stuff from banging into future satellites?
The scary thing is nothing.
It's
become a problem. NASA does, in fact, have an office of space junk. And a friend of mine actually ran for a while. And they are trying to keep track of everything that they can. There's just thousands of pieces of stuff up there. It will come down. It's mostly in near-Earth orbit, 100, 200 miles or so up. And there's a little residual atmosphere up there, and that gradually cleans it out, and the stuff will all it's a self-cleaning mechanism in a way. So if you reduce the level of pollution up there, eventually it'll improve itself, fortunately.
You still have to go between here and there. You have to go through this group.
Well, you got to be careful. I mean, the International Space Station is orbiting in an area where, there's still stuff flying around from paint chips to bolt heads, and you don't want to get hit with something like that. If it's in a crossing orbit in any way, you're dealing with orbital speeds. You're dealing with thousands of miles an hour, and it doesn't take much to do a damage. There's a classic picture of the windshield of the space shuttle with a big chip taken out of the glass. Apparently it was hit by a paint chip. So you got to be – it's become a problem. I don't know if it's a deadly problem now, but it could be unless it's handled.
Is there any way to – trap these to catch them?
Well, as I say, they will come down. Give them 10 or 20 years, most of this stuff will come down by itself.
Yeah, but by 10 or 20 years...
There's really no way of sweeping it up. You just have to be very careful about reducing the level at which you pollute the orbital space.
And how do they keep track of something as small as a paint chip?
Well, I don't think you can when it gets down that small. They do keep track of the larger pieces by radar from the Earth.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So actually, someone has done a map.
You should see the map. It's incredible with the amount of stuff that's orbiting the Earth. I mean, just useless junk pieces of explosive bolts, gloves. I think there's some astronaut gloves or something. There's paint chips. There's all manner of stuff. You know, you do something technological, there's always some debris associated with it, and there was a little too much. People weren't paying attention in the beginning or weren't able to control it. I think it's much more controllable now, although I'm hardly an expert on that.
Mm. And eventually, why is it that eventually it does?
Well, all the orbits of anything in near-Earth orbit, you know, these things only orbit a couple hundred miles up. The Earth is 8,000 miles wide, so they're very close to the surface of the Earth, and the atmosphere doesn't just stop. So even a 100, 200 miles high, there's a little bit of air and friction between these particles, and any satellite in the air will gradually degrade the orbit and bring it down. That's what happened to Skylab years ago.
So eventually, eventually gravity...
Well, it gets slower and slower, and as the body slows, it spirals into the Earth. An orbiting body is a falling body. It just can't catch up to the curvature of the Earth, so it keeps going around and around. It's no different you standing on a chair and jumping off. You're in orbit for a little while. You hit the Earth gets in the way. If the Earth weren't in the way, you'd go around it. And that's what's happening to the satellites. That's why they're in orbit. They're controlled by the Earth's gravity. And otherwise, you cut off the gravity of the Earth, which you can't do. The satellite would just go flying off in a straight line, Newton's first law. So it's the gravity that keeps it in orbit. You hear constantly people saying, well, there's no gravity up there. That's why it's in orbit, which is not absolutely wrong. It's the gravity that keeps it in orbit. And if you slow it down a little less than orbital speed, it'll approach the Earth. The orbit will degrade itself. All near-Earth orbiting satellites will do this. You have to get it out quite a ways before they won't come down anymore, and there's not any atmosphere to degrade it anymore.
Hmm. Okay. About 10 minutes left here with U of I astronomer Jim Kaler. You have astronomy questions, call us 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Here's another question.
Oh, yes, yes.
Does the moon affecting the tide of the ocean, does it help contribute to lessening of the pollution that you would get on the ocean otherwise?
Well, it probably helps sweep things in the beach back out to sea again, certainly. But it also brings things back in. If you've ever been to the sea when the tide has rolled out, there's shells and all kinds of stuff sitting on the beach. So I doubt that it has, you know, any relationship to pollution. It has a powerful relationship to life on Earth. There are a huge number of tidal animals, for example, that exist in tidal pools that occur after the tide has removed itself. The tide is a stretching force by the moon. The moon stretches the Earth and its waters out in a line toward the moon. The Earth rotates under the stretch waters, and you get high and low water. It's an ocean phenomenon. You don't get it in the Midwest. Even Lake Michigan is too small. But it's quite a spectacular thing if you're at the beach and watching this ocean come in and out and in and out, and often with pretty spectacular results. It can go up. Was it the Bay of Fundy? The top to bottom is a 50-foot difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most extreme tides in the world.
Yeah, and the tide, they have all kinds of effects. The tides produce a friction on the Earth. They slow the Earth down. The day is lengthening at the rate of a little less than a thousandth of a second per century. This factors into clocks, and it really makes a mess out of time, accurate timekeeping. There are all kinds of interesting effects involved here. But I think in terms of pollution, no, I don't think that would have any effect on it.
Well, I was thinking in respect to the oxygen that would, you'd get from the tide coming up and everything.
Well, you're getting out of anything that I know much about, but there's certainly a strong relationship between the oceans and the atmosphere in terms of gases going in and out. But you'd really have to ask an oceanographer a question like that. Maybe Dave can get one on sometime and fascinate you with this wonderful body of water that we have around the Earth. What do you think? How about getting an oceanographer?
Hey, sure. I'm open to that. We'll do that. Have we answered your questions?
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Very good. Let's go to Terre Haute in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Last fall, my cousin and I were traveling in Wichita and then north up around St. Joe, Missouri, and during that time, I believe we were in Wichita coming out of a restaurant, and she and I were walking to the car when an automobile pulled in very fast and rather dangerously, we thought, and he said, look at the sky. And there was a streak, a huge, long, sustained light. Hmm. And someone said it was space junk. that was coming back.
Did you actually see it going across the sky?
Yes, we did.
It could well be reentries. I've never seen one, so it's hard for me to relate to it. But from people I know who have, it's apparently quite a spectacular sight to watch a reentry of a satellite of any sort. And it does happen periodically, so it could well be. I'm not familiar with that particular event, but I gather it's quite a sight, especially for a large one.
Well, it must have been fairly large because I would guess that it lasted, we watched it. It was probably 15 minutes that it was moving across the sky, and it left a tail bigger than any comet.
Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't think it would last that long. An orbiting satellite will go from California to New York in about 15 minutes. But I think, and I'm going off on a limb here, some of these things should be able to leave trails behind them, ionization trails, and maybe that's what you saw. That's my best guess. I honestly can't tell you.
It was spellbinding.
I can imagine. I say I've heard of other people, and I've seen some pictures of them, and they're supposed to be pretty terrific to watch.
Well, I'm old enough that the day the Earth stood still certainly crossed my mind. Thank you for being on.
You're welcome.
I hope that maybe in August, for a change, we will have clear enough skies. My daughter's birthday is August 11th.
You can celebrate with a Perseid meteor shower in the middle of summer.
We try to, but how difficult that can be.
Beautiful thing. It's really a beautiful thing. They've been quite active over the last few years, too.
Oh, I just love it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. And Jim Keeler is our guest. He's a professor of astronomy here at University of Illinois. We have about 5-6 minutes left on the program. You mentioned the fact that the International Space Station is under construction, and I'm sure that we'll be hearing a lot more about that. I just wonder what is new in the way of taxi service, so to speak.
We've had
this technology that's been, when the shuttle was first launched in the 70s, was it?
I can't remember that either. My memory's going.
Or maybe that's when they first
started. But the cost of this is spectacular. It costs a huge amount of money to launch that shuttle. So you're just going to willy-nilly transfer people back and forth. You got to have a good reason to do it. Beyond that, I can't really tell you much.
So about what is there? Is there still talk about there? About having to have something new, something that will replace that eventually.
Oh, the shuttle? I don't know. I can't answer you. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry.
What about other things that are just happen to be new and exciting in the world of astronomy?
Oh, we got a wonderful X-ray satellite orbiting the Earth now, which looks out into the sky and does all manner of X-ray observations. The space astronomy has the word revolutionized doesn't really describe it. It's opened up all of the radiation that can hit the Earth, the atmosphere blocks, from gamma rays, high-energy gamma rays, through X-rays, ultraviolet, infrared rays. I mean, the list goes on and on. We understand so much better what the universe is like now than we did, say, 30 years ago, when we were stuck pretty much looking at optical radiation through the Earth's atmosphere. It's made a tremendous difference to astronomy.
Well, what besides things that we can see, what all is there that can be observed if you have the right kind of instrument?
Oh, rotating neutron stars that produce only gamma rays or X-rays, for example, that you can't see from here, interstellar gas clouds that we hardly were aware of that are producing nothing but radio, molecular clouds filled with all manner of organic molecules, and we didn't know this until we could focus a radio telescope on the clouds. All low-temperature processes just produce low-energy radiations you can't see, so we didn't have any idea what was going on out there. We had no concept of what star formation was like and how stars are born until we had the capability of looking through at the radio waves and at infrared radiation. I mean, the list is just almost interminable.
Hmm. So when you look out there and you see the stars, but you see a lot of this blank space in between.
Oh, it's not
it's
blank.
It's not empty.
No, it's not empty.
It's not empty.
And, of course,
space.
There's an awful lot out there of little tiny bodies, things that you don't see optically that affect us, even affect us directly. There was one famous case last year, I think last September, of neutron stars about the size of the Champaign-Urbana, 20,000 light years away, that, quote, adjusted itself, unquote, and kind of a minor adjustment for it, and the radiation from it ionize the Earth's atmosphere back to daytime levels and cut off saturated many Earth orbiting satellites. The darn thing is 20,000 light years away. You're in the environment. You really are in a space environment, and you're physically touched by the things that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't realize this 30 years ago.
Hmm. Well, we're sort of at the point where we're going to have to wind down. Any last thing that you'd kind of like to leave folks with?
Oh, and it always comes back to the nighttime sky, and for all the spectacular things and fantastic neutron stars and star formation and all of this, it's great fun. I think it still comes back to the nighttime sky, going out in the quiet evening and looking at Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn in the twilight.
All right. Well, for people who have access to the Internet, there's lots of astronomy information on the web.
A great deal of good information, too.
And one place that you might start would be the webpage of the U of I Astronomy Department, which is
www.astro.uic.edu. Right. And from there are a few clicks there, but you can get on to almost any NASA site. NASA has been doing wonderful work in education, especially children. They have made it a dedicated effort that a certain percentage of grant money and so on go toward education. They produce some terrific websites.
Very good. And for people who would like to also read more about astronomy, you can look for some of the books that our guest, Jim Kaler, has written. The last one, the most recent one in print, is The Little Book of Stars, and we talked about that last time he was here. Little just in physical size, but has a lot of information in there.
Big on information.
Big on information, right. And easily portable. And then this one that you can find soon, it will be out, Extreme Stars at the Edge of Creation, published by the Cambridge University Press. Well, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.